I started broadcasting before I actually finished university. I started when I was at university at the student radio station there. I had thought that I was going to go and write for newspapers because that was my idea of what journalism was. There was a faint hope that I might be in television, but not really, because people on television news didn't really look much like me. The closest at that time who looked anything like what I was like was Yana Vent, and she's clearly in a league of her own. And I don't know that I had any hopes as high as that. But then I went and played with the radio station, thought it was fabulous. And as a result, I worked in community radio for nearly a decade, for about 9 years, in both Melbourne and in Armidale in rural New South Wales. And I don't know that I thought very much about my cultural background in relationship to my work for a very long time, until when I was living in Melbourne. We had a change of government at that time, and we also saw for the first time the One Nation Party, which was voted in. And it was a surprise to me because I was not sure that I understood what was happening there. And it was one of the things that prompted me to move to a regional area to understand a little bit better the parts of Australia that I didn't know. And at that stage, I'd only grown up in Melbourne. There was a lot of Australia I didn't know. I mean, Melbourne's a big place, and I hadn't just lived in the inner city. I'd also lived in the suburbs, and things are very different in the suburbs than they are in the city. But yes, it was a different thing again. And it was a really good thing, I think, for me to do that. Then I moved to the ABC, first in Tamworth and then to a number of other parts of Australia. And for a long time, I was just learning my craft, fitting in, doing what was required of me, and also learning the places that I was in, because that's also important too. So I had to learn the different locations, you know, the New England Northwest region, Hobart and Tasmania, places where I spent short amounts of time, like Wollongong or Darwin or Horsham in Western Victoria, also Sydney and Melbourne. I spent time in all of those places. So you have to learn those communities. And what was interesting to me about all of that was, after a while, as I became more confident in what I was doing, I noticed that when we talked about Australia and Australians, we tended to think about a dominant kind of Australian, and every other kind of Australian was sort of a little bit off to the edge. And then after a while, I realised I was one of those people who was off to the edge. And I thought, I think we can do better than this at the ABC.
So why did you want to look at diversity in broadcast media specifically, and not just as an ex-content maker, and you still do make content from time to time, but how that works at all levels in a media organisation?
You're right to remind me that I used to be a content maker, Rhianna. I have both presented and produced programmes for a very long time. Why? Such a good question. I had to go back and think about what was bothering me about what I felt was a gap between the reality of life as we live it in Australia and what we were seeing in the media. And in entertainment media, there's always a gap, because when you're in entertainment media, you're telling a fiction, and a fiction is very often it's an ideal representation of what your place and time might be, all the way up to speculative fiction, if you like. But in news and content, I felt as though we weren't quite representing all parts, and we weren't hearing the voices of all parts. And why did that bother me? It bothered me because I do feel as though if you don't hear or see the kinds of faces or voices in the media that you see down the street, then the media is sort of a place where we concentrate our hopes and our fears, our dreams and our concerns. It's where we talk about things like politics, and politics is what determines our future in the country, the directions that we might take, decisions large and small through Parliament and so on, right through to what we consider important at local council, or what is interesting in the arts, who is interesting to us in sport, who's achieving in science, all of those things. And if we aren't seeing and hearing the full range of voices involved in those things, in the media representation of those things, then it's as though those voices and faces actually don't exist. And if they don't exist, then how can we imagine making policy for those people? How can we imagine taking them into account? So I didn't want to be living in a country that was, by default, allowing our society to break apart or to be sort of fragmented. I actually want us to be closer together, to understand each other better, to work out our differences, to have differences, but to be able to figure out a way forward as a whole country and what Australia actually is. And that's why it matters to me.
So, Andrew, do you think the media has been a little bit slow in changing to the community that we have now, and understanding that the makeup of that community has changed since maybe the establishment of those organisations?
I do think so. And it's funny because the average Australian, I don't think it has got their head under a rock by any means. I mean, you just have to walk down the street in any capital city in Australia and just see Australians and all our wonderful diversity. I'm not sure that if you walk off the street and into any media organisation, whether that's commercial or public or community, whether you see that full range of people inside the organisation. There's your litmus test. If you walk from the street to the organisation and you see a gap, then there's your gap. And I do think we have been slow. Media organisations can often be a little bit conservative because we tend to react to the news, we tend to react to society. But I do think that until very recently, as in until this year, we have been lagging behind in a noticeable way.
Was there a reason, Andrea, why you specifically chose to visit and look at the way that diversity worked in policies, but also in representation on air and also in content, by visiting those groups in the UK and Sweden? Was there a main point behind looking at particularly those two countries?
Look, it was mostly practical consideration. I wanted to make this a short trip because I think that you can choose to study something like this forever. But for practical reasons, 6 weeks was my limit. I decided to go to the UK because it was an English-speaking country. I felt I could speak to a lot of people there without too many language or cultural issues. Also, they have a system of media which is not dissimilar to Australia's. So the BBC reflects what the ABC does, except much larger there. And their commercial media is the kind of commercial media that you might see in Australia as well. Sweden I went to for a point of difference. They have a very strong public broadcaster also, but their treatment of languages is otherwise different. Both of those countries also have very high immigration rates, but different kinds. The UK's immigration rates, like Australia's, are historic, and they've had a very multicultural society for a very, very long time. Sweden has become an extremely multicultural country, but there has been a very big influx of a certain kind of migrant very recently. So they have both a historic kind, but a very different kind through the influx of migration into Europe in the last couple of years. And so they're dealing with that as a social issue as well. So those were the reasons why I went there.
I'm Rhianna Patrick, and this is ABC Local Radio, and Andrea Ho is my guest. She's one of the 2015 Churchill Fellows, and the topic that she looked at was practical strategies for increasing cultural diversity in broadcast media. And as you heard there, she spent 6 weeks looking at broadcast media organisations in the UK and also Sweden. Andrea, what were some of those common themes that you discovered, and which organisations, media organisations, are doing diversity the best? I mean, what do you think it could be best practice for, say, what we might do at the ABC?
Well, I think what was interesting to me was that when I arrived in about March this year in the UK and then Sweden, what I found was that overall the conversation had moved on beyond, is it a good idea that we look at diversity? And had become a conversation about how do we do this better? We need to do it better. So at that stage earlier this year, they had already stepped beyond what we were doing in Australia, which was both interesting and comforting to see that you could get beyond even having an argument about it, which is great, which is terrific. Everybody was doing it differently. And perhaps the one common thing that I saw was that there is no one single solution that makes this right. In which case you say, well, how do you make it work? So in my Churchill report, and it is freely available to anybody who wants to look at it online, I picked out 10 common themes that people raised as being important things that they had to crack or address in some way within their organisation to further diversity. Everyone was still struggling with it. You've got to say, nobody had felt as though they were doing 100% the very best they could, but everybody had also made inroads. Some of the things that you saw across more than one organisation, including the commercial organisations as well as the public ones, which I thought was interesting, were things such as keeping track of how your diversity was going, counting figures, so metrics, and setting targets to go with the metrics. In other words, they had well and truly had a discussion and were completely over their discussion about whether or not it was okay to set a target and whether or not they should measure the metrics, because as they commonly said, if you value something, you measure it, don't you?
Andrea Ho is my guest. She was one of the 2015 Churchill Fellows who looked at practical strategies for increasing cultural diversity in broadcast media. She is my guest here on ABC Local Radio. Andrea, on that, one of the things that I found quite interesting in your report when it came to deadlines and the pressure that we all feel with trying to find the right person, but also thinking outside the square of, is there someone else that we haven't spoken to in that space that could give a more diverse look at something, was I think it was in Sweden where they allow their reporters to spend maybe 2 to 3 weeks getting to know a certain area of the community. They don't have to file. It's all about making connections, learning about the community that they're supposed to be reporting on, and giving them space to actually let that happen. Was that a really interesting concept to you?
It is, and I think it's something that we need to think about. These are tough things to think about in times when we are dealing with reducing budgets, and that's not just a comment about the ABC, I might add, because our commercial colleagues are also, I think, looking down the barrel of more competition for their advertising dollars as well. But you say to yourself, we need to invest in our product for our product to be good for a listener. So therein lies the challenge, I think. We have to think differently about what we do, and that's the big challenge, because I think we are very goal-driven, very outcome-driven in the media, and that's right and proper, but that can hinder our thinking. If we can just unhook ourselves from saying we always have to come in and produce a program today, maybe in this 12 months, at different times in the year, we can spend as much as 3 weeks, maybe even as much as 1 week, just going out and meeting the community in different ways and hearing different stories and observing people. Maybe that's possible, I think. There's a lot of ways in which I think it's possible to do that. And in fact, I saw some quite innovative things in Sweden. The example you're talking about is something that's happening in Stockholm, where they're actually sending community correspondents out into the community. And what's interesting about that is they don't necessarily expect those correspondents to file a story every single day. They consider that a productive day may be spent hearing the points of view from 3 or 4 or 6 or 7 different people in the community and thinking about those. But they had to find the money for those extra correspondents, and those correspondents are not attached to a program. They don't have 3 hours that they have to fill every single day. So you do have to look at what your pressure points are in your production structure and to alleviate those. There are other ways of doing these things as well. For example, in Malmö, another very innovative thing they did, which I thought was really interesting and quite risky in a media sense, they decided that they would have a 2-week experiment on the radio, where for that 2 weeks, they would try their best to interview only guests who were underrepresented on the station, who they felt were of diverse background. Now, let's be clear about what this means. This includes women. And I find it astounding that even in other countries, not just a problem in Australia, that you can have 50% of the population women and still have well below 50% of your radio guests actually being women. You know, there is a disparity which you just think is a bit of a no-brainer. We've got to fix that one. So they wanted to chase people who were women, who were people of diverse cultural background, people from LGBTI background, people with disabilities, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds. And they decided that where possible, all their guests that week on the radio would be from only one of those backgrounds. Now, the whole station decided to do it. There were skeptics in the station. There were people who said it couldn't be done. There were people who said that it would not make good radio. But they thought they would give it a go and just see what happens. And as it turned out, they had a very high percentage. There were a couple of people they really couldn't avoid, who you might call from your old format of male, pale and stale. But they tended to be, I think, people like local politicians who you had to hear from because they were connected to a particular story. But otherwise, they said, we had to work a little bit harder, but not as hard as we thought, to find those people. And it made the radio sound more interesting. And it had some other effects as well, such as more people came into the station. There were more women. And I said, well, what was the impact from the audience? And they said, well, the audience really didn't say anything. The manager had recalled one phone call she had with one listener who rang up and said, what is this? You don't seem to be talking to any Swedish people anymore. What, are Swedish people not good enough? She said that was one person who rang. Everybody else just listened as usual. So in other words, people were hearing the voices that they heard down the street from the people they saw down the street, and it was not a surprise for them to hear them on the radio.
And the CBC have had some success with this in Canada, haven't they, where they very much looked at what the groups were that existed within Toronto and how they could better reflect the community of Toronto. And it took them a while to get that right, not only in their on-air presentation, but also getting communities to engage with them, whether that was in calling up for talkback or whether that was being interviewed for a particular story as well. So it does take time. And is that one thing that you discovered, that time is always the factor in this, that it's not going to be something that can be done automatically overnight?
Yeah, look, I think that's an interesting observation. CBC are world leaders in this area and have been in that space for a while. And Susan Margetti, who was the director of CBC Toronto and is now the director of CBC Radio overall, she's an amazing woman, did take quite a data-driven approach in that sense. And this is something that I saw in both the United Kingdom and Sweden. They knew a lot about what their population looked like, and they knew about the groups that they were not serving as well as the groups that they were currently serving, and they understood what their gap was. But yeah, it does take time to change, and there's good reasons for that. You know, you can't just sack a bunch of people and parachute some people in. That doesn't work, and nor would anybody want it that way, because our organisations are filled with excellent professional people and we're not about shoving them out the door. You also, I think, have to spark the imagination of people who aren't currently included. I mean, when I said I wanted to work in the media when I was at high school growing up, you know, my parents, my family, they all thought I was mad. They all tried to dissuade me because they just said, you're not going to get a go, you know. And if you look at media organisations today, they might have been right to worry about that, because there aren't very many people who look like me or like you, Rhianna, for that matter. So they were right to worry. So we do have to spark the imagination of people who might want to do this, but whose parents are afraid that it's just not a career option for them.
Well, Andrew, I mean, how has this Churchill Fellowship, I suppose, shaped your perceptions, but also your ideas around diversity in the media? Have you found a shift in the way that you've thought since doing something like this?
A couple of shifts, I think. The first of those was, it was a surprise to see how Australian media and Australia in general was thought of in the space of diversity, particularly cultural diversity. And in the end, my report is about cultural diversity because that was the project that I outlined. But I found that all organisations were dealing with diversity in general. Cultural diversity was a part of that. So, you know, you really couldn't unhook cultural diversity from, you know, gender or socioeconomic diversity, whatever. But I was surprised at how they saw it. So, for example, when I was in London, it was at the time when the Logies for 2016, the finalists, were announced. And the whole Logies So White hashtag happened. Do you remember that blowback?
Yeah.
Well, I was at Sky at that time talking to a broadcaster there, Afua Hirsch, and she's an amazing lady. She and I just said to her, have a look at this. The Logies have been announced, and we've got this hashtag going because there's criticism about Waleed Ali and Lin Chin being finalists, popular finalists in the popular awards, mind you. And she said something along the lines of, oh my God, Australia is so racist. You know, is it really like that? All we see is, you know, Home and Away and Neighbours, and it's all so white. And is Australia really like that? And I said, well, as a country, Australia is nothing like that. That, you know, maybe if you go to one or two suburbs, it looks a bit like that. But really, you know, Australia writ large doesn't look anything like that at all. But I understand that if that's all you see, then that's why you think like that. And then you start to reflect and go, wow, that's what Australian media is actually a lot like. So that was a real eye-opener, really seeing how other people see us. You know, she was there saying, gosh, we've got some problems in Britain, but, you know, you Australians, you've got quite a way to go. So that was one thing. The other thing that was interesting to me was how much I think I'm starting to find my own voice on this particular matter. And that's, I know, a bit of a cliched way of saying it, but for a long time, I've felt as though I was kind of sticking my hand up saying, well, do you think you could think about other kinds of Australians who look like me or look like you, Rhianna, or whatever? Do you think that's okay? And I wasn't confident about it at all, because I thought I was wrong, or I thought I was stupid, or I thought that people wouldn't be interested. And as it turns out, as we start to make more of this kind of content, people actually are interested. And it was a nice example that I had a look at the BBC. It was a project called 100 Women, and it was run by BBC International. And again, it's written up in the report, put together by a marvellous lady by the name of Fiona Crack. She was inspired after the awful story in India of that young couple who went out to the movies and were enticed onto a bus as they went home. And both of them were severely beaten, and she was raped, and she later died. And it was an appalling story. And she said there was such a strong audience reaction to that, that they felt as though they needed to look more at the kinds of issues that faced women. And so they came up with this concept where they wanted to speak to 100 women in 100 days. And they spoke to women from all around the world in all walks of life, astrophysicists, managers, doctors, lawyers, all kinds of people. And they did a lot of those stories online, but they also did a lot on air as well. And she was really careful to look at the metrics. And she said it was fascinating. Somebody had to teach her how to look at the numbers and what to be looking for. But she said as she was reading them, what she realised with this project is the number of women looking at BBC World just went through the roof.
Really?
You know, so many more women tuned in and wanted to read and hear those stories. And I said, oh, that's interesting. She said, you know, it was really interesting. And I said, no. And she said, the number of men reading and listening didn't drop. So if you make interesting content, people will want it. And it isn't only one kind of thing that's interesting. Many kinds of things can be interesting if you make them interesting by putting the work in. So I found confidence in saying, you know what? Stories about this kind of person in this kind of life are also interesting if you make them interesting. And I'm finding a lot more confidence in being able to say that now, and to also say people who have those life experiences have something to contribute in the workspace, and go out and look for what you don't have on your floor, and that should be what you're trying to bring in, not more people who look the same as the people you already have. I do think that there is something that we have to do in Australia, and again, this is something I learnt particularly looking at the United Kingdom example, that is that if people have already tuned out because they don't think that you're broadcasting for them, then you need to go out and tell them that you're open for business. And so we need to get our house in order. We need to do better with our content. But then we can't just assume that people roll up, because we now want to talk to listeners who didn't grow up in Australia and who, say, didn't grow up with ABC Kids, you know, Play School or whatever, or who did grow up with Play School but then tuned into the news and found that their local suburb was continually misrepresented. I mean, you know, every time, even now, every time I see a story about where I grew up, it's usually a story about robbery or high gang levels or whatever. Really, you know, my experience growing up there and my experience when I visit Dad there even now is not like that, but they're the only stories I see in the media. If that's what you see represented, you tune out. So if we want to bring those listeners back, we have to do better with our content, then go out and say, hey, we've changed. You're going to like what you see or hear. Come back and try us again.